The United States of America has entered a new normal with catastrophe after catastrophe hitting our nation and hitting the world. From natural disasters like floods and fires and drought to man-made environmental disasters like pollution pouring into rivers and contaminating our food sources, causing food insecurity. All of these issues are connected, and all of them are things that we can do something about before we get to our breaking point. And to discuss our breaking point, we have the author of Breakpoint, Jeremy Jackson, here with us in the studio. Now, I have to start with, this is a book about science, but it's also a very weighty book. And you've been called Dr. Doom and Gloom. In your own TED talk, you talk about how depressed you are. So let me put this bluntly. Exactly how fucked are we in America?
Well, we're really in a lot of trouble, but this, you know, let's just say I had an epiphany or something, because I think I've reached the point where I see that most of the challenges that we face in the United States environmentally are actually tractable. Some aren't, but the good news is most are. And I think now that we've won the battle of getting people to take more seriously the challenges we face, it's really important now to...
Do you think we've won that battle? Because there's a lot of people that don't take it very seriously.
Well, there are a lot of people who don't, but you know, take a state like Florida, it's still illegal to talk about climate change in a government building, much less sea level rise. But the good citizens of Miami Beach, who get flooded by every full moon high tide, and the people all up the Atlantic coast who are scared to death of sea level rise and being wiped out, they're getting it, and they're getting it really fast. And so I feel very strongly that we're at the point where we do have the opportunity to engage and talk serious stuff about what we're up against and, to a very great degree, how we can fix it.
All right, well, before I get to solutions, let's cover, just establish what exactly are the problems. So you talk about what we're facing and how we're reckoning with a crisis. In the book, you talk about natural disasters and human-made disasters, which are becoming one and the same. What sort of challenges are we up against? How bad is it?
Well, we're up against a legacy of stupid local policy, which has made virtually every part of the country more vulnerable than it needed to be to climate change. So for example, in the Corn Belt, which is much diminished in its power compared to the glory days of producing more than half the grains in the entire world, but it's still incredibly important. But we're producing this stuff in really environmentally unfriendly ways, and the consequence of that is to make the Corn Belt vastly more vulnerable to the effects of climate change. The same is true in the Mississippi Delta. And these are the two aspects of the environment that we spend the first half of the book talking about. The southern coast of Louisiana is drowning into the Gulf of Mexico, and it's drowning for two reasons. The first long-standing reason is we've done a lot of stupid stuff, like build unnecessary dams on the Missouri and Mississippi rivers that have starved the coast of sediment, which nourishes the coast and counteracts the effects of subsidence. All deltas in the world sink under the weight of the sediment, but the reason they survive is because good sediment comes down the river to counterbalance what is lost, and we cut off that valve. And we starve the Mississippi Delta of sediment. And then we're dumping all this nitrogen and poison down the river because of unwise agriculture. That's weakening the marshes, et cetera, et cetera. And then that's all more vulnerable because global warming due to climate change is causing sea level rise. So you've got the Delta sinking faster than it used to, and having sea level rise faster than it used to. And the result of that is that the Mississippi Delta is disappearing at an astounding football field in area every hour.
Wow.
And so the
wow.
I think most people
That's
recognize
huge.
That the southern coast of Louisiana will be at Baton Rouge within 50 years, and New Orleans will be this little city on pilings, sort of regulating
Venice.
The shipping traffic. Well, not as nice as Venice. and you know, the big difference
North
with Venice
French.
Is that Venice is inland, and sure, it's sinking, and it's a big mess, but there's like an outer barrier, and they're already building an artificial human barrier to supplement that, and they can certainly buy 50 years for Venice. They might buy 100 years. We ain't going to buy 50 years for New Orleans because it's the whole coast.
So in addition to the people of New Orleans, who is most affected by this human-caused catastrophe?
Well, you know, it's really funny. We talk only about climate change, and there's no doubt in my mind that climate change represents the most serious threat to us in the long term. And don't get me wrong, I think there are some aspects of climate change that we're stuck with and that we're going to have to adapt to. Although I believe there's a lot we can do to make it a hell of a lot less of a problem. But, you know, in the Corn Belt, all of this agriculture, which is sort of, well, it's all genetically modified corn and soy, and that those crops are dependent on a poison called Roundup, and they're dependent on a certain kind of tilling and plowing of the soil, which is pretty destructive. So, you know, they're losing half a centimeter to a centimeter a year. That's half an inch of topsoil every year. Yeah, sort of like this. And because of...
Every year.
Every year, every year. It'll be gone in 100 years if we don't wake up. And then, you know, that's our bank. That's our piggy bank for agriculture in America. But the most shocking threat, which I have to admit I had no idea of until I dug in to the situation for this book, is that, you know, there's a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico from all this nutrient going down the river and fueling phytoplankton. And
a dead zone?
A dead zone. It's a big area of water in the Gulf of Mexico the size of the state of New Jersey, which doesn't have any
itself
oxygen.
A dead zone.
Yes, well, yeah, one could say. But there are beautiful places in New Jersey. There aren't any beautiful places in the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's because the oxygen is sucked up by too much plant life, which grows because of too much fertilizer, the excess nitrogen from farming in the Corn Belt. And that too much plant life, it dies, it rots. That sucks up all the oxygen, and anything that can't get out of Dodge dies. So you get dead fish. And they suffocate. They can't breathe. They die.
Ugh.
But there's also a dead zone up north, and that's what I didn't know about. Lake Erie is huge. It's maybe about the size of New Jersey. I'm not quite sure of that. And there are times that when you look at satellite pictures of Lake Erie, they are iridescent green in color enhancement. And that iridescent green is a reflection of the extraordinary abundance of toxic cyanobacteria that undergo these extraordinarily dangerous blooms, which are so bad that, for example, when one occurred off the city of Toledo near its water input, they shut down the water supply of the city for 3 days. Cyanobacterial toxins can be deadly. You can't filter them out of the water. Boiling doesn't help. Cleaning the water costs a fortune, maybe in some cases thousands of dollars a person a year to make the water clean. And the concentrations of this cyanotoxin in drinking water in the Midwest is way above the danger level in a huge proportion of the reservoirs and groundwater of the Midwest.
Wow.
And that's all because of a kind of agriculture that could be fixed. Now, that's the stuff that there's no excuse for not fixing. Because what's driving it you know, a few pennies profit margin for a lot of people who could do better. Sea level rise is a whole different story. And that's happening, and it's going to get a lot faster before it slows down, even if we do the right thing. Although if we do the right thing, which means really reducing our fossil fuel use and CO2 emissions, we can make a big difference. But you know, then it's sort of a throw of the dice as to the situation of the place that might be affected.
Mm.
So a city like New York that was badly damaged.
Where we are right now.
Where we are right now, which was badly damaged in Hurricane Sandy. And I'm really happy I live on the Upper West Side because I'm way up above sea level. But right down here, you know, we're not.
We're here in Chelsea.
And so New York.
Right on the pier. Pier's
right on the pier. That's right. And so New York is scrambling to fortify the coast of downtown. And they're getting started on it. They're not ready yet, but they're working on it. And the reason it can work is because New York is built on solid rock.
Mm.
And so if you build a wall, and if you're smart about it and realistic, you can buy 50 or 100 years. Miami, on the other hand, it's time to move. And I grew up there. I know that city like the back of my hand. All of South Florida is like a sponge. It's porous limestone. I remember as a kid, we lived in the highest point in Dade County, something like 13, 15 feet above sea level, on this limestone ridge. And I remember when I was 10 or so, a couple of piddling hurricanes, category twos. And we had a sinkhole on our property. And, you know, it started to fill up from rain, but it also filled up from the surge
of
the storm pushing through that honeycomb sponge beneath the surface of the ground.
So the surge under the
ground.
And
pushing the water up.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, with 5 feet of sea level rises, which is what we're sort of thinking now.
It's not just stopping at the coastline. It's under the...
It's under, yeah. And even if it didn't go under, 5 feet of sea level would drown virtually all of Miami Beach and about a quarter of Miami. And you wouldn't want to live there anyway because it would be an island. The fresh water would be completely poisoned by the salt water which penetrated in. And not to mention all of the diseases that would be caused by the hotter temperature and the swamps around the city and whatever. And yet, and this is criminal, the city and the state still continues to encourage investment in building and the luring of retired people to spend all their savings to buy houses in places that are going to be drowned.
Well, we have flood insurance, Jeremy. Don't
no,
worry
we don't.
About it.
No, we don't, because the government flood insurance program is broke. You can no longer get a federal mortgage without buying yourself the flood insurance, and a $500,000 house in Florida, that might cost $25,000 a year.
Oof.
And the government is not going to pay for it. So if you have a federally backed mortgage, like a Fannie Mae or something, in South Florida today, you might lose your home if you couldn't afford to pay the mortgage. But Florida says, Governor Scott says, everything's hunky-dory, come to Florida. And there's a great, great coastal scientist named Orrin Pilkey who said several years ago, and it's in print, Florida is an outlaw state and it will pay the price for its lies and cheating about its vulnerability. So, you know, you can, and we do this in the book, you can sort of take New York and you can take Miami and say, well, in the case of New York, for sure, we're not doing it fast enough.
But you can't do it.
We got this stupid quarrel between Cuomo and de Blasio. I mean, like, boys grow up and get together and spend the money. I mean,
that should be the new campaign slogan.
It is, you know, it is demonstrably the case that $25 billion will buy the two barriers to protect the inner harbor from, like, the Far Rockaways to Cape May, and somewhere east of LaGuardia and a little bit around Kennedy to buy us at least 50 years. and this is a proven technology. Now, that's $25 billion, a lot of money. Sandy, just for the official losses, was $65 billion. Mm. So why didn't we do it yesterday?
Yeah.
But we can do it. And in the book, we actually show two maps of the Cadillac version and, you know, the Honda Civic version of the two plans to protect New York, which, like, guys, let's start to do it faster. And I don't want to be too critical because actually a lot is happening. You know, there are oyster reefs being built that really
are... The Billion Oyster Project.
The Billion Oyster Project is cool. I'm not sure how much that is a part of the new oyster reefs and salt marshes protecting the east side of Staten Island.
Yeah. Don't worry about Staten Island. We didn't want it anyway.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's very pretty. And, you know, when I drive from my kid in Brooklyn Heights to get down to D.C., I drive over it. So I admit the only time I'm ever there. But there's some beautiful wild land in Staten Island. And it's one of our most important residential boroughs. And, you know, a lot of people live there and they need to be safe. And And we can do that.
Now, I want to talk about those people. By the way, if you're in Florida, why?
You're there because it's beautiful, it's warm. I loved it when I was a kid. I have to admit, I cry when I go back. Because what I remember in the 1950s, that I'm not antediluvian. In the 1950s, I can remember going to, if you can believe it, Key Largo and seeing three people all day.
Oh.
And so now, you know, it's just, it's a different world from that sort of childhood dream.
Like yourself, can leave. They can afford to get out of this terrible situation of...
Yeah, but a lot of people are stuck. And
who are those people? Did you meet them in this book?
You know, we didn't travel specifically to Florida for the book because I live there.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, I know a lot of people down there. I know a few rich people who just get on a plane.
Yeah.
I know a lot of retired professors from the University of Miami who would be screwed, but they could at least afford to get out and they have IRAs and retirement, but most of their money's in their homes and you can't put your home in an airplane. And then there is like the half the people in Miami-Dade County and really and St. Petersburg and Tampa, really the whole southern half, two-thirds of Florida, about half of the people, most of what they own is in their property. And if their property is drowned or destroyed or whatever.
That's it.
And what are we going to do with 5 to 10 million climate refugees in the United States of America when that Category 5 finally hits? We had a Hail Mary last year. If Irma hadn't grazed Cuba, screwing Cuba, which saved Miami, and then if there hadn't been a little sort of blip and it suddenly headed east and went right up the middle of the state instead of drowning Tampa and St. Petersburg. So Florida got a total Hail Mary pass. But, you know, in the late 20s, when the last Category 5 hurricane bullseyed Miami, it drowned the city. There were only 125 or 150,000 people then, and over 1,000 died.
Oof.
Now there's more than 5 million,
Oof.
And they live in all the stupid places. So, like, when I was a kid, you know...
Not because they're stupid, but that's because...
No, because they were lied to.
Yeah.
So, when I was a kid, it was against the law. The zoning law to build a house on Key Biscayne. Well, B.B. Rebozo, who is Tricky Dicky's friend, Nixon, sort of fixed that. And so, you know, now huge numbers of people live on Key Biscayne, which is underwater during bad hurricanes. I mean, underwater. And it's connected by this narrow causeway. And if those people don't get off days in advance, just
they can't
get
think,
off. You know? Yeah. So,
well, same in New Orleans. You talk about New Orleans.
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting about New Orleans is that the people who live there, and interesting, mostly the African-American people who lived in New Orleans, they realized the gig was up. And so, and one of the things, in spite of the slow response of Washington, The evacuation of New Orleans, for the people who made it to the evacuation, not the people in the stadium, was one of the most brilliantly designed evacuations in history. And these people, there was this diaspora, and they went all over the South, and they didn't come back.
Yeah, they're still
They didn't come back. They're making new lives in other places because they're smart. Mm-hmm. And that's principally, really, the African-American and poorer population in New Orleans. The reason the population is increasing again in New Orleans is because of young kids like you, the techies,
the
media
dumb
people
kids.
And everybody. Well, they're
like,
not these, dumb.
These properties
dumb.
Are
they
so just, cheap.
They've never been there.
Yeah.
They've never experienced it. And the job's good, the salaries are good, so they go. And so I really worry about that. And in fact, there's a brilliant woman we talked to in our book named Shirley Laska, who's one of the nation's authorities on risk, a major, major person who speaks very eloquently in the book about the threats and what she worries about. And this is a beautiful person who's worked with the indigenous and poorer communities of the New Orleans and Delta region all her professional life. So there are going to be a lot of victims, no matter how you slice it. And as always, it's the disadvantaged, the people who perhaps didn't have the education, didn't have the opportunity, or simply cannot afford to move out. And
you see it in Flint. You know, we're talking about water contamination. There's people living in Flint still that don't have clean water. There's people living in Puerto Rico that still don't have electricity.
Oh, yeah, well, Puerto Rico is disgusting. I mean, Flint is disgusting, too. I think,
not the people,
no,
just to be clear.
I think Flint is a clear case of official criminality.
Mm.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. And it was racist, obviously. I mean, like, they didn't give a damn because they weren't people like them. And it's disgusting. Mm. Puerto Rico is disgusting in a different way. You know, the challenges in Puerto Rico are vastly greater.
Mm.
I mean, in Flint, they could just say, we totally screwed up, we're totally guilty, we're really sorry, and we're gonna spend $1 billion or whatever it costs, and we're gonna pipe clean water into the city yesterday, problem solved. I mean, it's harder than that.
They could do it.
It's harder than that because you'd actually have to fix all the pipes that service the water, but at least you could have a standpipe. You know, that delivered the millions of gallons a day that would be needed and have trucks that delivered it to everybody while you fixed it. Puerto Rico's a bigger deal, right? I mean, the entire infrastructure of the island was destroyed. I wouldn't want to think of what we're going to discover. Creepy stuff we'll discover in some of those isolated valleys as we, you know, as the efforts continue to move out. It's overtly racist, Puerto Rico, because, you know, mostly white neighborhoods of Houston have gotten incredible attention. And
they got their power back.
They got their power back, and mostly Hispanic by definition. Puerto Rican citizens of the United States have been screwed. Let's just stand back from this. When we were finishing the book, I always worried, you know, Dr. Doom and Gloom, I always worried I'm being like Cassandra, I'm overstating the case. Steve Chappell, my co-author. Is a professional journalist. He's written a bunch of books. He's a really good journalist. And besides making the writing a lot better from a dorky scientist, because he writes beautifully, the other thing Steve did was play the incredibly important role of a skeptic about sort of Cassandra-like stuff.
Yeah.
And so we used to debate throughout the writing of the book. Throughout it, we would talk about, are we overstating this? Are we understating it? Trying to be responsible in the balance that we struck. And then, oh my God, you know, we're finishing up the book. We're practically final editing.
Mm-hmm.
And the summer of 2017 happens. And in 5 weeks, we've got Harvey, Irma, Maria, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Three major...
All of which you predicted.
We predicted, but it blew my mind. I mean, I'm good at this stuff. This is my field.
Being a scientist,
I gave a talk at the Naval War College, and I was invited back to teach their national security group. The original talk was called Too Little Water and Too Much, and it was about drought and sea level rise and increased intensity of storms. And by the way, the Navy takes it very seriously because they're data driven. They don't care about the politics. Mm. They care about the science and saving people's lives. That's
what
they do.
Unlike our president.
Well, yes, I would agree. So, I mean,
I was insecure
because you always worry about I'm a scientist, and scientists, you know, are maybe too conservative. I'm a lot less that way than most, but I'm a scientist. And then, oh my God, you know, bang, 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 the three storms. And even I've got to say, I just never imagined anything like that. And so we rewrote huge parts of the book.
Mm. To incorporate those natural disasters.
Yeah, and you know, I just want to say one quick thing, because I'm sure we're going to run out of time. The first is that the National Hurricane Center had predicted that 2017 was almost certainly going to be a worse than average year. Mm. And guess what? They've just predicted for 2018 that it will probably be a worse than average year. So you have to ask yourself, what will the summer of 2018 bring? And are we preparing? Hell no. We haven't done a goddamn thing in the federal government to make us less vulnerable.
So I want to ask you about the last question. What can we do to protect ourselves? Because this is coming no matter what. And what can we do to help change things, help mitigate these disasters?
Well, what we can do to protect ourselves is to individually examine where we live, what the threats are, and think about it very carefully, decide whether there's a safe future there or not, and if there isn't, if it's within our power as individuals to move or to increase our chances.
What can we do as a nation?
Along with that, I would say even locally, throw the bums out. You know, if you got a governor who says climate change and sea level rise isn't a problem, you know, impeach the bastard. And if there's an election coming up, go out there and vote. Nationally, it's really the same thing. We need to be utterly objective. We need to recognize where the situation is likely to be unresolvable, so that we should throw our money and our energy and all our resources into helping the people in harm's way. And in the places where there's a rosier future, we should be, you know, everything we can possibly do to make that future safer and rosier. I mean, this isn't rocket science. It's very straightforward. And the thing that really upsets me is that although the numbers are huge, they are far smaller than the trillions, and I mean trillions of dollars, and we document that in the book, that we will have to spend if we don't take preemptive action.
Well, there you have it. Buy a copy of Breakpoint if you haven't already. Jeremy Jackson is a scientist, so you can believe him when he says it's very important that you go out there and vote in this coming election, and you are responsible for changing things in the ballot box, but also in your everyday choices. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
It was hugely fun. I really enjoyed it.
And grab a copy of Breakpoint if you haven't already. Thanks for joining us on TYT. See you next time.